1971, which he sold with the title Various Subjects Drawn from Life and on Stone. The print in Bonner's collection was entitled Horses Going to a Fair, and shows a group of strong horses, Percherons, being driven to market by two men. It is highly likely that Rosa Bonheur had also seen Jericho's drawings and oil studies of the Roman horse race, because certain characters and groups in her painting, such as the horse leader in green trousers to the left, exactly mimic the stance and expressions of Jericho's Roman prints. Clearly, art does not arise only through the artist's engagement with the material that is provided by reality or their social or natural environment. Art is created in dialogue with other art, with precursors, role models, competitors. Art is aware of its own history and its own self-referencing. Horse painting, which might fall within the genre of historical painting, animal painting, or as a dramatized segment of social reality, is no exception to this rule. In both Jericho's Berber's Horse Races in Rome and Bonheur's Horse Fair, we can still make out the outline of the Parthenon frieze procession from the pediment of the Temple of Athena. See page 158. The comparison with the ancient frieze, of course, also shows just how much the dynamic sculptors among the painters, including Jericho and Bonheur, owed to the study of anatomy, which was unknown to Phidias. Bonheur may have studied horse anatomy from books. Of Jericho, it is said that he was in and out of the slaughterhouse and the morgue, like anyone else might visit the opera or a brothel. As with Stubbs before him and Adolf Menzel later, hair-raising stories were told of the stench of decay in his studio, the perfume of heroic realism. Such was his reputation that by the late 19th century, any anatomies without clear attribution and circulation in artists' estates and collections, whether studies of heads, arms or legs, sketches of horse or human skeletons, severed heads or body parts in every stage of decay, were generously ascribed to him. Jericho was considered the painter of the most gruesome realism. In the morgue and in the pathologist's lab, he found a reality without precedent. It seemed as though in the study of anatomy, the old dream of all realists and materialists of a prima materia, a subject free from all artifice, had been fulfilled. In the bloody art of dissection, beautiful art seemed to have gone into an apprenticeship under the tutelage of science, the artist's pen closely following the anatomist's knife. Keeper of the Void. Even at 70, George Stubbs had not lost his appetite for work. The Turf Gallery, which he had opened with his son in 1794 in London's Conduit Street, showed all the signs of becoming a financial success. While their leading and most influential precursor, the Shakespeare Gallery, exhibited paintings by British artists of scenes from Shakespeare's play, at the establishment of Stubbs' Père et Fille, you would expect to see the most famous racehorses, painted by Stubbs Sr. and made into prints by Stubbs Jr. In other words, the gallery was a semi-official hall of fame for British racing, and at the same time, a private showroom for the uncrowned king of sporting art, that subgenre of painting devoted to the racing and hunting pursuits of the upper classes. It is thought that the heirs of Colonel Dennis O'Kelly, the owner of the legendary racer Eclipse, were behind the enterprise. That the Turf Gallery found itself in the red and had to close after 4 years was perhaps linked to the devastating effect the war with France had had on the printmaking business. But in the balance sheet of its symbolic capital, the enterprise showed how close the racecourse had shifted towards Mount Parnassus. The day was not far off when a racehorse would achieve legendary status or become, as the writer Robert Musil put it, a racehorse of genius. George Stubbs had been in the horse painting business for nearly 4 decades. As a successful artist, he had accompanied the phenomenal rise of the English racing scene and had seen this world from every aspect. Horses became celebrities and changed owners every year, which meant they had to be painted every year, whether to be immortalized in effigy or simply to push up the price. Races which, like the St. Ledger, were barely off the ground but already deemed classic events. The racing calendar and bloodline records which aimed to elucidate the convoluted family ties and demonstrate a horse's equine nobility, meat traders, who had risen through the ranks to become racehorse owners, and gentrified estates, which came under the hammer because their owners had wagered their assets on the racecourse. Stubbs had closely followed the Formula One of his century and at times lived well from it. As a painter, he was both a parasite in the system and at the same time one of its key players. To this day, he epitomizes the lasting image of England's Grand Odalisques. He was the Angre of the stable. By the mid-1750s, he had discovered his niche and had executed an unprecedented coup. For 18 months, he worked in a barn in Hawkstow like a man possessed, dissecting around a dozen horses which he bled to death in order to avoid causing any damage to their bones, tendons, or veins. He worked for weeks on one of the carcasses, for which he had designed an ingenious hoisting device, seemingly oblivious to the terrible stench and the risk of sepsis. And since he was both anatomist and artist, and both with the same virtuosity, he dissected and sketched ceaselessly, without pause. Every layer of muscle that he exposed, he at once got down on paper, labeling the sketch in detail. Eventually, he boiled the skeleton and charted it, too, meticulously recording every individual bone, like an archaeologist working on the remains of an ancient city. These were the heroic years of such archaeology. In his barn in Lincolnshire, George Stubbs excavated the temple of a pagan cult, the anatomy of the horse. Stripping away and exposing layer after layer, he penetrated into the depths of the body. Five tiers of muscles, tendons, and veins were painstakingly recorded in his drawings. In the uppermost layer, the volumes of flesh are still intact, only the skin has been peeled off. Then scalpel, pen, and eye penetrate deeper. The fifth illustration shows the deepest layer of ligaments and tendons directly attached to the skeleton. So as not to disrupt the clarity and beauty of the picture with numbers and labels, for each plate, Stubbs provided a corresponding numbered line drawing and legend of muscles, etc., and their functions. In his methodology, both the layer-by-layer progress from outside inwards and also the way of presenting the reference material in a separate diagram, Stubbs stayed close to the approach taken by Bernhard Siegfried Albinus a decade earlier in his Atlas of Human Anatomy. Stubbs followed the German anatomist and the Dutch graphic artist and engraver Jan Vondelaar in the normative aesthetics of representation, too. Just as Vondelaar had presented the écorché, the flayed human body, or skeleton, well-proportioned and in an elegant pose, so Stubbs also displayed his dead horses with the elegance and grace of an animated young animal, trotting casually like a dancer. From one look at Stubbs's graceful ideal animal, one can clearly see the breed of horse in question, the Arabian-influenced English thoroughbred. The anatomy of the horse represents an archaeology of the racehorse. There is one striking way in which Stubbs deviated from the precedent set by Albinus and Vondelaar. He dispensed with the Arcadian backdrop. His beautiful and spine-tingling horses do not have idealistic vistas unfolding in the background. Stubbs presented his horses in a void. Thus, with his anatomy, the masterpiece of a young artist, Stubbs began to reveal the feature of his painting that would secure him a singular position in the history of art. The isolation of the animal body, free of accessories and window dressing, and the suppression of the natural environment. Stubbs, who painted his horses with such photorealistic precision that each model could be recognized as a distinct individual, which breeders and owners particularly valued, was quietly radical in an abstract approach which was quite ahead of its time. Save for the slightest shading beneath the feet, Stubbs did away with everything that was not part of the stallion, mare, or foal. These few paintings of beautiful, shimmering horses took on an iconic quality, although the gold of these icons was no halo or shimmering background, but a glimmer of light on his subject's brown coat. There are only a handful of these images in which Stubbs renounced any kind of narrative in the form of landscape, people, accessories, or other details. The most famous of this series is the portrait of the riderless stallion Whistlejacket in the Levard position, with his head turned ever so slightly to face the viewer. it has been described as one of the most significant images of the 18th century and the most significant horse portrait ever painted. There is a theory, a rumor fed by Stubbs himself, that it was a half-finished equestrian portrait of George III, in which, for various reasons, the background and the addition of the king by another artist were never executed. In the case of other similarly abstract or absolute portraits, such as the Mares and Foals series, from the same year as Whistlejacket, 1762, it is more difficult to explain the genre. An equine group portrait, a frieze, which, as Werner Busch demonstrates, obeys the laws of the golden ratio with as much virtuosity in its execution as enigma in its meaning, if, indeed, it has any at all. Perhaps these radically isolated images, with their idiosyncratic auras, are something of a secret destination within Stubbs's work. Not in the sense that this painter was only capable of horses and dogs. His oeuvre demonstrates that he was also competent at landscapes, although they remained conventional and unoriginal. He would not have entered the pantheon of great painters for their sake alone. More interesting is the way his Newmarket horse and jockey are dressed. Here we find the same recurring buildings and details, as though the painter had long since grown weary of such padding. It's amidst this architectural indifference that the emptiness of Stubbs's portraits creeps into view, and with it comes a mood of escapism, which foreshadows the 20th century realists, such as Edward Hopper. For Stubbs, the fullness of life is only to be found in horses, and all the more so when we abstract this from all distracting worldly references. The Arcadian atmosphere with which the Mares and Foals is imbued comes not from an antiquated idyllic setting, but rather from the fact that they are literally set free within the freedom of the empty canvas. It took a long time for art history to put Stubbs's Anatomy of the Horse on a par with Philippe-Étienne Lafosse's Cours d'Hippiatrique, although the differences between them are not so great. Both works originate in the same period. Stubbs's anatomical drawings were published in 1766, 6 years before Lafosse. It is not known whether Lafosse was aware of Stubbs's work. These were the wild years of both equine studies and anatomy. The stacks of literature were being produced on both sides of the channel, as well as great art. Both authors were experienced, passionate anatomists. Both amassed years of anatomical experience in their youth, dissecting dead horses in their teenage years, replacing book knowledge with autopsies. Stubbs had an advantage over his French colleague, who was 14 years his junior, in terms of his skills as an illustrator and engraver. But Lafosse knew how to buy in from outside. He hired illustrators of the quality of Haguignier and Soulier, and a small army of the best engravers and printmakers. The result, 65 hand-colored prints, is as grim as it is startling. It depicts a dead horse as a carcass on the dissecting table, or suspended on a hook. Parts of the body are open, revealing the muscles, individual organs or major blood vessels, veins and arteries. Plate 15. The power of this vivid portrayal comes from the position in which the corpse is presented. Legs splayed, tongue hanging out. The multiple perspectives of the same image and the bizarre overall impression of cubism having arrived around 1.5 centuries too early. Compared with the elegant classicism of Stubbs's portraits, Lafosse's surreal graphics come off worse. The politically correct 21st century critic describes them as an irritating aesthetic of sensual and anthropomorphic depiction of violence. Was Philippe-Étienne Lafosse a precursor of the splatter film? In fact, it seems we're looking at two fundamentally different aesthetics in the visualization of the horse. Both Stubbs and Lafosse have their roots in the scientific practice of their time, and both satisfy its stringent requirements in terms of precision and detail in how forms are rendered and functional relationships are represented. Both return again and again to autopsy and to a body of knowledge that comes not only from the eye, but also from the hand of the dissector. Both are motivated by the desire to support the practitioner, whether breeder or artist, and to delight the connoisseur, the aspiring veterinary surgeon or farrier. But while Stubbs ultimately lets the aesthete within him prevail and, with his anticipated clientele in mind, shows the dead horse in a graceful prance, Lafosse presents the cadaver as an object of gruesome investigation, as flesh to be dissected, while Stubbs's horses look as though they might yet trot back from the studio to the stable. LaFosse's corpses are not going anywhere. A Golgotha of knowledge. In Paris, the Bastille fell, and with it the spirit of despotism, while in Berlin, the Brandenburg Gate was erected, which, over the next two centuries, would become Germany's gateway of destiny. Inspired by the Athenian Populaia, it became the symbol of the nation and saved its architect from the oblivion into which he, a man of the second tier of German architects, behind Andreas Schluter and Schinkel, would otherwise have easily fallen. The gate kept Karl Gotthard Langen's 1732-1808 name alive and recalled an architect who, in helping himself to elements from architectural history like a child rummaging through his box of building bricks, managed to produce some unmissable works. The finest of his oeuvre, and the most spectacular for all its external restraint, was built at the same time as the famous Brandenburg Gate, and not far from it. The Veterinary School's Anatomical Theatre, which after years of redevelopment, has recently been reopened to visitors. Besides the elements of classical architecture, it is also sculpture which connects the two buildings, the City Gate and the Anatomical Theatre. Johann Gottfried Schadow crowned the Brandenburg Gate with the quadriga, a group of figures of consummate grace and verisimilitude. The devastation of the Second World War and the conservation efforts of the GDR left nothing intact of Schadow's original besides the monumental plaster cast of a horse's skull. This skull was returned to his birthplace as part of the exhibition on the history of Berlin's veterinary medicine. Like Adolf Menzel, after him, Schadow studied and drew not only live horses, but also availed himself of the skulls and skeletons in the equine study collection in the Animal Anatomy Department. Berlin's Veterinary Anatomical Theatre, or Zootomi, was commissioned by King Friedrich Wilhelm II, and was built in the years 1789 to 1790. Externally reminiscent of Palladio's Viella Rotonda in Vicenza, on the inside it seems to be flowing in the footsteps of its precursors, the anatomical theatres of Padua, 1594, Leiden, 1610, and Bologna, 1637. Langen's originality was evident not only in the transfer of such a venue to the flourishing field of veterinary medicine, but also in the technical features of the auditorium, or perhaps, we should say, viditorium, for it was for watching the proceedings as much as for listening. At its center stood a dissecting table, which was both rotatable and retractable, making it possible to raise an animal corpse from the depths of the building and to make it visible to the audience from all sides. Unlike his predecessor, Friedrich II, who had been keen to see pets as well as cows and sheep investigated, and sought enlightenment about the rampant Rinderpest or cattle plague, Friedrich Wilhelm II brought the spotlight of veterinary medicine back to its political and military core purpose by focusing mainly on horses. The carcasses which the rotating dissection table raised into the scientific limelight were, at least in the early years, exclusively those of horses. In place of the ancient theatre's proscenium, the anatomical theatre of modern times set a more intimate scene, the autopsy table. At the heart of the tragedy were the organs and fibres of a dissected corpse. The drama explored the symptoms that disease had etched into the body's tissue and the indicators which portended that stony guest, death. The amphitheatre's tiers of seats rose in concentric circles, directing the student's perspective onto the fragment of a corpse that had been isolated by the pathologist's scalpel for investigation. The anatomical theatre's dissection table rotated, allowing the audience to examine the object in question from all perspectives. No detail escaped the attention of the spectator. The anatomical theatre is a huge apparatus that encompasses the audience and serves the purpose of directing and training the eye. It leads the spectator from merely looking to reading and deciphering signs. This theatre is the stage of modern science, where tokens of death have a systematic, pedagogical purpose. Langen's Zootomical Theatre fits precisely within this tradition of the modern observation apparatus. Its rising table enables the effortless delivery and removal of large and heavy carcasses in the vertical plane. The corpse, prepared in advance by the dissector in the basement, appears to float in and out of the audience's field of vision, like an equus ex machina. The architect of this extraordinary building won his spurs in the theatre of the performing arts. Now another field was benefiting from that theatrical experience. All traces of the slaughterhouse and the knacker's yard are banished to the basement. Only sanitized specimens are permitted access to the main floor. The pure phenomenology. But the Zootomical Theatre's dissection table evokes not only the stage of classical theatre. It also conjures up the altar of an ancient temple. This is what is suggested by the frescoes of garlanded Bucrania decorating the dome of the theatre and circling its walls. The work of the Berlin painter and engraver Bernhard Rohde. But the animals slaughtered in the basement are no longer the sacrifice brought before the old bloodthirsty gods. These animals die for the sake of science. At a flying gallop. In the demonstration hall of the Animal Anatomical Theatre, the inner nature of the horse is laid bare. The audience in the tiered seating observes the architecture of the skeleton, the texture of the muscles, the volume of the chest, and the expanse of the lungs. It knows the speed and the endurance of this creature bred for the racetrack. It is, however, only the deceased animal that is seen, not the trotting, galloping, jumping version. The dissection reveals only the musculoskeletal system, the apparatus of movement, but not the motion itself. The gentle trot, suggested by Stubbs's anatomy, is an added aesthetic ingredient, like the flowing mane and billowing robe of Jacques-Louis David's Napoleon Crossing the Alps. Essentially, Stubbs's anatomical drawings were static. The horse, the great mover, here remains unmoved. Even the levade is just another form of stasis. Indeed, it is the paradoxical climax of stasis. For a fleeting moment, the horse rises to a vertical position, before the sublime figure returns to all fours. Blériot's Berber horses, painted half a century earlier, are the product of another age, creatures made of light and tempo, metaphors of dynamic motion. In 1821, during his second stay in London, it was suggested to Géricault that he should produce a Cours d'anatomie cheval à l'usage des peintres et des amateurs, a textbook for equine painters and connoisseurs. It would be along the lines of Stubbs's work, but for a new era, updated for contemporary tastes. Momentarily, he was on fire and began to draw, not horses in motion, but rather the motion within horses. The reason for Géricault's visits to London in the early 1820s was unrelated to horses, however. He was motivated by the poor reception of The Raft of the Medusa in the Salon of 1819. When Géricault exhibited the painting in London the following year, the crowds rushed to see it, and it was warmly received by the critics. He made a second visit to London in 1821 and stayed most of the year, mainly preparing lithographs to sell, but also seeking English customers for his scenes of horses and racing events. He whiled away whole days at the racecourse, where he became friendly with a wealthy horse trader, Adam Elmore, from whom he bought three beautiful animals. The sketches which emerged in this context show the English thoroughbreds and their jockeys with the same dynamics and the same circular swirls of energy that swept through his Roman Berbers. These studies show Géricault at the height of his dynamic, dramatic art. But then something strange happened. The painter became something of a chameleon, blending into his adopted background. From being a pioneer of French Romanticism, he emerged as an English sporting artist, a decorator, a furnisher of manor houses. Géricault produced an oil painting, which he either gave to Elmore or offered as a down payment for the racehorses, it's not quite clear. The work is entitled The 1821 Derby at Epsom, Plate 14, and may have also been intended as a teaser for the British clientele he hoped to attract, for it corresponded to their tastes exactly. The 1821 Derby at Epsom can only be understood as a deliberate imitation, a pastiche, if not a parody, of the most current type of English racing picture, as familiar to the public, and certainly to Mr. Elmore, as the Britannia on the penny. In fact, we can hardly discern the hand of the master. Where is the impulsive sensuality of his Berber horses, the erotic flexibility of their limbs, the painful beauty? Jericho had adapted himself so thoroughly to the stiff-legged, roughly hewn horse painting of the English school, it is as though he had just graduated from their ranks. His runners at Epsom look exactly as if they were the work of a popular artist of the day, such as Henry Olkin or James Pollard. As in their paintings, in Jericho's we even see the horses levitating in a flying gallop, with forelegs and hind legs stretched out straight at the same time, all four animals captured simultaneously in the same flying position. The horses appear to hover, while the jockeys do not crouch in racing position, but sit upright, like the pilot of an aircraft, as if clutching a steering wheel. Jericho, a passionate rider who was intimately acquainted with the motion of horses, knew that his picture defied physical reality, that it was anatomically incorrect. The sketches from the same era betray him. But he was also well aware that such were the conventions of English art, which its buyers were used to seeing. This was another kind of cultural correctness to which he needed to adhere if he was to succeed in London or Newmarket. Beauty was in the eye of the customer. So, might the 1821 Derby at Epsom not have been a crafty move by a versatile artist who was trying his luck in a new market? Indeed, it might have been. It's hard to know for sure, because in December 1821, Jericho gave up and took his English horses with him back to France. In the remaining 2 years of his life, he found other occupations. His Epsom racehorses hadn't provided him with a new formula for representing speed and dynamic motion in pictorial form. This was the formula for which French painting, from romantic orientalism via historical painting through to scientific realism, searched over the next few decades. And the pressure intensified with the rise of physiological knowledge and new graphic recording methods. The climax came when officer and anthropologist Émile de Housset published a work in 1874 in which he criticized numerous previous representations of striding and running horses as inaccurate, and corrected them with the aid of schematic drawings. Jean-Louis Ernest Meissonier, a leading historical painter of his age, was receptive to this critique, and prompted by de Housset's suggestions, he revised a picture in 1888, which he had painted 24 years previously, 1814, La Campagne de France, which at the time had been praised for its historical and hippological accuracy. The following year, he corrected another historical painting, which he was still working on, 1807, Friedland. But the more he fiddled about with his horse's postures, the more he attracted the criticism of experts. He simply could not shake off those annoying critics. Physiology and hippology had taken aesthetic criticism hostage. Suddenly, everyone was claiming to know how to paint a horse and how not to, and the only people who didn't know were the artists. Meissonier came to feel the bitter irony of the whole affair. Paradoxically, it was he, the most scrupulous among French historical painters in the pursuit of verisimilitude, who was singled out by the realism nemesis. The blow was all the harsher, given that he was such an enthusiastic rider. In 1867, Menzel counted 8 horses in his stable. He would sit for hours on end on the Champs-Élysées, pencil in hand, watching the spectacle of riders and carriages, unmoved by the scorn of fellow painters such as Degas. In the garden of his studio, he had a track built, along which he could move smoothly on a small rolling platform, a dolly as they say in the film business, pulled by an employee as he sketched a horse running alongside him. But even those tracking shots avant la lettre did not prevent him from slipping up as he sought to represent a horse's gait. The graphic evidence lay on the table. This nemesis of realism had a human face and a name. It was Étienne Jules Maret. His extensive studies of the movements of people, horses and dogs walking and jumping, birds in flight, fish swimming, and insects scurrying, resulted in 1873 in a sensational work, La Machine Animale, which the following year appeared in English and spread his insights worldwide. Although the Machine Animale still depended on experiments with electromagnetic, pneumatic, and mechanical recording methods, it helped trigger the ingenious series of photographs taken by Edward Muybridge from 1877, funded by the railway magnate and horse breeder Leland Stanford. Their publication, initially in 1878 as The Horse in Motion, and in the following year as Attitudes of Animals in Motion, electrified Murray, encouraging him to establish the photograph as a meaningful recording technique. In 1887, Muybridge in turn marked the culmination of his photographic motion studies with the publication of Animal Locomotion, a huge collection, with 781 plates in folio format. The story of chronophotography and its protagonists has been told so often that we can restrict ourselves to a brief mention. However, if, as often happens, we compare Murray and Muybridge's work, we should bear in mind that these were two very different kinds of researcher. On one hand, we have Murray in Paris, a physiologist of national and international renown, the successor to Claude Bernard at the Collège de France, with a corresponding list of publications and academic lectures to his name. On the other hand, in Palo Alto, we have Muybridge, a figure of dubious moral stature, who had to suffer the insult that his powerful patron, Leland Stanford, described him dismissively in the preface to The Horse in Motion, 1882, merely as a hired photographer. Muybridge must have felt all the more triumphant then at his positive reception by the great and good in the scientific world when he came to Paris in 1881. The reception for him at the home of Murray on the 26th of September, 1881, was attended by the physicists and inventors Gabriel Lippmann, Jacques Arsène d'Arsonval, and Hermann von Helmholtz, besides numerous friends of the host. At a second reception 8 weeks later at the home of Meissonier, the crème de la crème of the Paris art scene gathered to honor Muybridge. For Meissonier, chronophotography represented a dream come true, the exact reproduction of motion. But this technique was also a trap that he could not escape. In truth, the series of photographs divided the accuracy of the moment from the fluidity of motion. By aiming for accuracy, Meissonier ended up failing to capture the fluid movement. In his paintings, all action came across as frozen. Like Meissonier, Degas was also fascinated by Murray's discoveries as they first did the rounds in the early 1870s. Degas, at that time, one of the spokesmen of scientific realism and an aficionado of the racetrack, was thrilled by the new perspectives of the horse conveyed by the new méthode graphique. Finally, it would be possible to depict horses with scientifically guaranteed accuracy. But as he concerned himself at that time exclusively with the human form, it would be some time before Degas benefited directly from the series of horse chronophotographs. It was only towards the end of the 1880s that he became inspired by one of the equine forms in Muybridge's Animal Locomotion. This was followed shortly thereafter by an about turn as he returned in the 1890s to his youthful errors in the portrayal of motion, so much more expressive than flat verisimilitude. Towards the end of the century, with the image of the injured jockey, plate 11, Degas returned to one of his early paintings from the 1860s, Sans the Steeplechase, 1866. Now, he reduced the scene to two figures, the wooden horse and the jockey, who looks like a child's doll, carelessly tossed aside. Nothing remains of the realism of the 1870s and 1880s, no trace of the accuracy made possible by Murray and Muybridge, and which Degas' colleague, Meissonier, still slavishly pursued. Degas had opted for wooden, doll-like figures and used them to discover modernity in painting. Perhaps Géricault, the putative opportunist of the English art market, was already on this path when he painted his wooden jack-in-the-box Epsom runners. Or, as Degas used to say, we attain the idea of truth through falsehood. For Degas, the Parthenon frieze was the first and probably the most important of all horse races. It was a worthwhile endeavor to seek to imitate its artistic truth. Phidias's horses, which Degas copied as an art student in 1855 from plaster casts in Paris and Lyon, opened his eyes to the thoroughbreds at Chantilly and Longchamp, which he studied 6 or 7 years later. The format of the frieze was the obvious choice for depicting the typical broad sweep of the racecourse, the high-release cavalcades, and the spinning rotation of legs as the runners tear along at a terrific pace. It was only late in the painter's life, when increasing blindness made it pointless for Degas to continue striving for a photorealistic reproduction of horses in their motion, that he seems to have turned away from the Greeks. He made his leap into modernity with his jockeys riding in a no-man's land of colour, on horses whose excessively long legs remind us of models on the catwalk, and with the help of archaic depictions of horses like those that survive in wooden toys and on fairground carousels. Connoisseurs and conmen. The fox as educator. 23 is a dangerous age in a man's life. At 23, you can get swept up by a passion that you won't shake off for your entire life. One young American fell victim to anglophilia when he was studying history at Cambridge in 1930, but that was not all. Along with his love of England, the country's history and its way of life, his enthusiasm also grew for English culture, to the exclusion of almost nothing that had been generated by an English quill or brush. When this anglophilia made the leap to the most important art form engendered by modern England, his fate was sealed. This art is not the stuff of exhibitions and museums. It is rooted in the life of a nation and its upper classes. It is an organic, polychrome sculpture, moving agilely with its many parts. The art form in question is horse racing, and its wild sister, fox hunting. As picturesque as an English fox hunt may seem with its green meadows and hedges, babbling brooks, glistening horses and riders gleaming bright coats, and the frenzied, bustling dogs, it is, in fact, the work of an artist who's combined all these elements into a lively composite piece, which, thanks to the movement of its parts, is in constant metamorphosis. Anyone who has seen the hunt can sense the vibrant pulse of English rural culture, the epitome of all that is fine, fast, and furious. And he will know the small demon who keeps the whole dance in motion, the tutor of the English nobility and the dancing master of the nation, the fox. More inconspicuous than the Spanish bull, that black mass of force and unbridled savagery, the threatening incarnation of the dark principle, by contrast, the fox is a diminutive embodiment of guile. The swiftest of the smart and the smartest of the swift. The fox is a practical philosopher and a teacher of earthly wisdom. Nations are formed not only by saints and heroes, they are also raised by animals. They need a totem in which they can find themselves. England was brought up on the fox, and almost every trick the wily British have up their sleeves, they have learned from this master of deceit. In Newmarket, the second capital of this horse-obsessed country, there is even a monument to the fox, housed in a roofed temple with four Ionic pillars. Unlike the children of the British upper classes, the young American was not born in the saddle. Initially, he encountered the great outdoors only in art and literature. Like many young people in the Western Hemisphere, especially those from well-to-do homes, sheltered and shielded against the hardships of social reality, for a long time, Paul Mellon knew the world of meadows, forests, and horses only from books. He spent hours on end as a child, rifling through old bound editions of Punch, the forefather of all comics. It was in the satirical cartoons that he first encountered the English upper classes and what seemed to be their natural environment and companions, hedges, ditches, horses, and dogs, and of course the fox. As an undergraduate in Cambridge, he set foot in this world and skipped lectures in order to ride with the hunt. At the same time, he began to indulge the artistic impulse of aristocratic culture to start a collection, starting with engravings and prints of traditional British sporting art, along with specimens of the abundant literature about horses, race meetings, hunting, and breeding. The hunt and the racecourse reflected everything he saw and read, from the characters of Samuel Alkin and Thomas Rowlandson to the shimmering runners of Stubbs and Benjamin Marshall. What other young Americans of his time found in Venice or Paris, Paul Mellon experienced on the turf of Newmarket, the coalescence of art and life. It was several years later that Mellon became a collector on a grand scale, after he had married and settled in Virginia. In 1936, he bought his first English painting, a Stubbs, Pumpkin with a Stable Lad, and it would not be his last. The great horse painter of the 18th century was the secret focal point of Mellon's continuously growing collection, which, 30 years later, when Mellon bequeathed his paintings and books to Yale University, had become the most significant collection of English painting outside Britain. Mellon had acquired his first racehorse in 1933, soon after returning from England. Not long after that, he started to breed horses himself, initially steeplechasers and later, after the war, thoroughbreds for classic flat racing. His most famous horse was Mill Reef, who, as a 3-year-old, won all the major European races, Epsom, Ascot, and Longchamp, in a single year, 1971. And to this day, ranks among the 10 greatest racers of the 20th century. When Paul Mellon was promoted to the Racing Hall of Fame, he was described by the equestrian journalist Terry Conway as the Renaissance Prince of horse racing. This was not only an allusion to Mellon's accomplishments as a breeder and the dazzling success of his racing team, the Rokeby Stables, but also to his humanist inclinations and his princely generosity. Mellon gave funds to Yale, his first alma mater, like no patron before or after him, and he patronized Clare College and the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge in a similar way. In conjunction with the foundation named after his father, Andrew Mellon, and with the help of his sister, he expanded the National Gallery of Art in Washington, as well as putting huge sums into other museums and collections: Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, the Tate Gallery, the Pierpont Morgan Library, and scholarly foundations such as the Bollingen Foundation. He also funded research which promised to promote the life, health, and safety of racehorses. Philanthropy and human welfare came away empty-handed. The Bollingen Foundation, founded in 1945, was intended to act in the spirit of C.G. Jung, a figure revered by Mellon and his first wife, Mary. Its history goes back to a number of encounters with the psychiatrist from October 1937. The Mellons were in the audience when Carl Jung lectured at Yale and New York. Mary hoped to find relief from her asthma from the inspired doctor, while Paul hoped to be liberated from the shadow of his overpowering father, Andrew Mellon, who had died a few weeks before. In the spring of the following year, 1938, the Mellons traveled to Switzerland for 2 months, first to Zurich, then to Ascona. On their last day in Europe, Jung granted them each a 15-minute appointment. He taught poor Mellon that his wife was suffering from an overactive animus. It was the horse in her that was wildly kicking and fighting for more space to run. Her husband was over the moon. Besides English art and the paintings of the Impressionists, Mellon collected works of equine literature from medieval times up the 20th century. As an Anglophile, he focused on English literature and the themes of hunting and racing. In this way, his friend, the fox, was naturally given pride of place in his literary collection. Classics of hippology, originally in Latin, Italian, and French, such as Giordano Rufo's Liber Equorum or Lagernier's École de Cavalerie, amounted to a mere fraction of the total collection. In most cases, it was their first translations into English which paved the way for them to enter Mellon's collection. One example is Federico Grissone's Ordini di Cavalcare, originally published in 1550, which Mellon acquired in its first English translation, The Rules of Riding, of 1560. The collection was first made publicly visible in a large format and richly illustrated catalogue in 1981 under the authorship of John B. Podesky, while Mellon himself selected the volumes and illustrations to be included. It was the very personal directory of a private collection, the record of the household library of a passionate rider, breeder, and racehorse owner, as Podesky put it in the preface. Many of the works listed, he wrote, emerged from a similar background. They were not written for the sake of profit or for scholarly motives, but from the desire to express a passion and to share it with others of the same disposition. It was not for the sake of earning money that these works were written, but because the author wished to share with others his sheer enjoyment of the subject matter. This short, easily overlooked sentence sums up the essence of the connoisseur as writer, someone who writes for the sake of his love of the subject, or rather, for the sake of his sheer delight in the subject matter. Mere enjoyment might be enough for the plebs, but the connoisseur seeks to indulge his pure delight. Whether one sees oneself as a devotee, an aficionado, or a connoisseur, what is certainly absent is the motive of making money. The motivation is rooted in passion and passion alone. In the catalogue of Mellon's collection, the immeasurable wealth of the collector lies discreetly in the background. What brings together devoted writers and readers is the intimacy of the household library. At its heart is the special breed of horse that was the focus of Mellon's passion, the classic English thoroughbred racehorse with an Arabian streak. The thoroughbred is the true protagonist of this polyphonic equestrian narrative stretching over six centuries. Mellon's catalogue is a poor bibliography, yet it is a grandiosely bookish homage to the noblest creature brought forth by England in modern times. Comédie épique. If poor Mellon had indeed intended his collection and its catalogue to be a tribute to the horse as such, then he would have started not with the 15th century, but with antiquity, something attempted in a comprehensive form by Frederick H. Huth. His bibliography, Works on Horses and Equitation, published in London in 1887 and reprinted 100 years later by Germany's most hippophile publisher, stretches back to 430 BCE, with the inclusion of surviving fragments of a treatise by Simon of Athens on horsemanship and veterinary arts. Huth's bibliography also emerged from the catalogue of a collection. But unlike Mellon's directory, it includes many curious and rare titles and narratives about other members of the family equidae besides the horse, such as the donkey and the mule. Thanks to the bibliographer's thoroughness, Huth's work is still used as a reference work by antiquarians and specialists in hippological literature. As it also included German language books, it provides a first impression of the development of a very specific European market, which in the 17th century and well into the next would stretch far beyond England, France, and Italy. While England, as the leading European horse-loving nation, also dominated the associated book market, the Italian influence soon declined, making French the second language of the hippophile world. From the last third of the 18th century, German authors and publishers of equine literature pushed relentlessly forward, to the point that in the next century, they would dominate the European market. But if we want to gain a broad overview of the world of equestrian literature, we can do no better than to reach for the work of a French general, Menessier de la Lance, author of the two-volume Essai de Bibliographie Épique, published between 1915 and 1917, was, as the title page notes, Ancien Commandant de la 3e Division de Cavalerie. In keeping with his background as a cavalry officer, this bibliographer sought to catalogue works relating to the horse and the cavalry. Anyone interested in such mundane objects as coaches and carriages would do well to consult the work of Gérard de Contades, Le Driving en France. Menessier represents a familiar type with only a slight change in appearance. He is a connoisseur in uniform. For every even vaguely significant work, he lists not only a short biography of the author, but also a concise summary of the text itself. If he cannot precisely identify the author or the publisher, he makes do with conjecture. He assesses the content and style of the text in question, restrained with neither his praise nor his criticism. He particularly gets into his stride when it comes to discussing the teaching methods of the famous riding schools and riding masters, École Allemande, École de Versailles. Menessier approaches other connoisseurs and collectors with a special warmth, including, for example, Charles-Louis Adelaide, Henri Mathévon, Baron de Cunier, born around 1811, died 1871, editor of Xenophon, and author of a major work of equine studies. He joined the general staff after training as a Hellenist, but left military service soon after to dedicate himself to études chevalines. His considerable wealth allowed him to travel extensively, especially to England, where he broadened his expert knowledge. His library of equestrian literature includes many treasures acquired from Houzard's library, in his time, the richest in the world. This brings us to Jean-Baptiste Houzard, a French veterinarian, 1755 to 1838, graduate of Alfort Veterinary School, one of the first of its kind, and architect of French veterinary medicine and military remount procurement. Houzard organized the supply and training of horses for the armies of the Revolution and of Napoleonic France. A second Talleyrand, he survived all the regime changes, became a Knight of the Legion of Honor, introduced the Merino sheep to France together with his colleague Daubenton, and built up the largest hippological library of his time, with almost 40,000 volumes. The catalogue of this great collection, published in 1842 by Edouard Leblanc in three volumes, was, according to Menessier, a precious resource in spite of certain errors because, with only a few rare exceptions, Houzard possessed everything that had been written on the subject up to 1837. Bibliographies don't have readers so much as users, but Menessier's bibliography makes for an unusually enjoyable read. You can take a leisurely stroll through this equestrian landscape. One biography of a rider and collector leads to another. One aristocratic stable greets another. The world of connoisseurship is a continuum, a network of names, provenances, and possessions. It is only in its external form that Menessier's book is a bibliography. Inside it is a rich, sprawling comédie épique of Balzacian proportions. He who knows how to read it will make the most astonishing discoveries. Before the reader's eyes unfurl the secrets of connoisseurs and traders, the races and the stands. New breeds of horses enter the arena, new fashions, diseases and cures, as well as new types of people, known as hommes à chevaux, not yet known to the society of the Ancien Régime. The wanderer through this text can experience en passant how the French developed their sense of the equine from the 18th century, and how they mastered riding and driving, like learning to walk a second time. A trip through Menessier's text opens up the strata of society in all their fathomable depths. Accompanied by the functional layers of knowledge that rewrote the centurion existence of modern society, the sluggish tempo of the country, the fast trot of the cities, the entire hippo-ontology of the French world. How strange and how regrettable that Bouvard and Pécuchet, those Flaubertian heroes of useless and hypertrophic knowledge, dipped their toes into every conceivable topic of study in their endless quest, and yet sauntered obliviously past the mighty hippological scholarly community of their time. The Science of Horses. Towards the end of the 18th century, the first works of hippological literature appeared on the market with titles asserting a scientific claim. What kind of strange constellation of knowledge is this that suddenly claims to be a science? What does it comprise of, and where do its component parts come from? We are familiar with the era around 1780, referred to by Reinhard Koselleck as the Saddle Period, when a number of disciplines emerged which would come to play a defining role for modernity. Suddenly, there they were, mingling with the old concert of sciences, these new formations of biology, economics, philology, geography, and history. From the confused magma of Baroque tableaux and histories, of relationships, allegories, and anecdotes, these new disciplines suddenly surfaced before us, young sciences of life, of people, their languages, and their history. In fact, their birth certificates reveal a lengthier provenance than we might think, looking back. Hippology, an old science with its origins in antiquity, was no exception. It was within the traditional mass of riding lessons, hippiatry, and manuals for grooms and stable masters that this new Faustian desire for knowledge emerged towards the end of the 18th century. On the eve of industrialization, urbanization, and the large-scale, fast-paced wars of the Napoleonic era, the horse, as the most important supplier of kinetic energy, moved into the spotlight of research, politics, and national administration. But a modern equine science did not rise suddenly from the traditional mixture of dogmatism and empiricism as a counterpart to human sciences. The development of knowledge of the Equidae family took a different path, as tortuous and as full of surprises as an English steeplechase, winding cross-country over ditches and hedges. A vigilant, market-focused publisher like Johann Friedrich Cotta could not fail to notice these trends. As with other genres, women's literature, horticulture, he responded with the publication of an annual almanac. Unlike a journal, which tended to be highly specialized and highly strung, This welcoming and chatty medium was well suited to the task of carefully luring in new readers and testing out the field's still uncertain requirements. So Cotter set to publishing an almanac of all things equestrian. The handbook for horse lovers, riders, breeders, veterinary surgeons, and supervisors of large stables, as its full title ran, was published every year on the 11th of November, St. Martin's Day. The first edition in 1792 was self-published by its editor, the equerry for the state of Württemberg, Franz Maximilian Friedrich Freiherr Bauvinghausen von Walmerode. But from the following year, the shrewd businessman Cotta took over and published it in an almost unchanging format, with an annual print run of 1,500, until he put it to rest 10 years later. Bauvinghausen's literary output was otherwise limited to short treatises on veterinary medicine, practical guidance for farmers on the treatment of horse hoof conditions and other animal diseases. In 1796, he published an Ordinance of the Duke of Württemberg's Studs. With his Handbook for Horse Lovers, however, he spread his net wider and offered instructive and entertaining tidbits from the field of horse husbandry, as well as news from the worlds of fashion, the nobility, and the professional classes. He rounded off his content with anecdotes and references to hippological innovations. With this broad range of topics, Bauvinghausen stood at the center of a ragged field of knowledge, which from the 1780s liked to refer to itself as equine science. In his Letter to the Public in the Almanac's first edition, that is, the editorial, he consciously described himself as part of this new discipline. The third and most substantial part of the annual publication consisted of a genealogical directory of the noblest living potentates, princes and princesses, secular and ecclesiastical. The long list of names in the vein of the Almanac de Gotha, a registry of aristocratic families similar to Burke's Peerage, made it clear who was the publisher's target audience, the well-educated, horse-owning and horse-breeding aristocracy, who needed to be au fait with all matters hippological. Both the Equine Almanac and the Quarterly One, two intimately related documents, were at that time, towards the end of the 18th century, still in search of their definitive systematic format. The Stud Book, the Register of Recognized Breeding Animals, and Goethe's Almanac, the Directory of European Royalty and Nobility, were two genealogical projects, both in need of a uniform, controlled format, an official version. The era of the many competing genealogical narratives, when every house and stud farm told its own story, was coming to an end. The bloodlines were being conclusively mapped. This was true for the English in a particularly clear, conspicuous way. As already mentioned, in Britain, the land of thoroughbred breeding, the registry of noble horses was already more established than that of human nobility. In Germany, national fragmentation, a pluralized and decentralized equestrian culture, and the relatively late arrival of the fashion for Arabian-influenced thoroughbred horses all stood in the way of the creation of a comparable national stud book. On the other hand, the genealogical record of human nobility was established earlier in Germany. The Almanac de Gotha was first published in 1763. In the early days, the Gotha, like Cotta's Almanac later on, consisted only partially of a registry of European nobility, while the rest was devoted to diplomatic relations and historical background. Bauvinghausen's Hippological Almanac included, first, reports on stud farms, racehorses and their offspring, followed by an excerpt from the Gotha, thus bringing together two strands which, at the time, felt closely related, the two great narratives of pure bloodlines. Despite its name, equine science, as it explicitly appeared in the last third of the 18th century, was not exactly a systematic and academically rigorous discipline, but rather a heterogeneous mix of branches of knowledge of varying status and repute. Anecdotal evidence was still deemed legitimate. Science, in the late 18th century, was not a protected or certified term. It had prestige, but no exclusivity. Unlike the contemporaneously emergent study of the diseases of horses, equine science was not limited to the study of the horse diseases and their treatment, but included other practical spheres of knowledge relating to horse husbandry and to the breeding, acquisition, and treatment of horses. Slowly and gradually, the old knowledge of the nature of horses, their illnesses and how to treat them, a body of wisdom collected and handed down throughout the era when the stable master, or equerry, was the keeper of such insights, was reorganized around the domains of the veterinary physician and the professional horse expert, or connoisseur.